Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, folks. We do have Paul with us again. And thank you for coming, Paul, and availing yourself. I would probably really enjoy having you when I do my Feedback Friday and my Game Changer, shows and so forth. But bottom line, I know you've got lots of things to do, and you're traveling around and doing great things, things that it's harder for me to do just because I'm doing this show. But, I mean, if we lend, if we're all lending our talents that we have available, then there's no doubt in my mind we'll actually get this stuff done.
Right.
So,
okay.
Anyway, so what we just read yesterday, folks, is we kind of started off the first part of this money debt of the union and the problem with paper money and these debts and so forth. And what jumped out of the page here is, how much money we're talking about and what the states, some states were doing and what other states weren't doing and so forth. And as we kind of had talked about the Assumption Act and so forth, but let's just finish this up and then we can debate or discuss the entire part that we've read. So again, this is Rufus King. And let me make sure, what day are we on here? So this is January 21st. This is Rufus King. And this is the second part or the second paragraph of what we're reading on page 42. So go ahead, Paul.
Right. Okay. After mentioning another requisition equally disregarded, Mr. King said, two states have not paid a single farthing from the moment, from the moment they signed the Confederation to this day. If my documents are to be depended on, and they are open to the inspection of all. Now, sir, what faith is to be put in requisitions on the states for monies to pay our domestic creditors and discharge our foreign debts for monies lent us in the day of difficulty and distress? Sir, experience proves, as well as anything can be proved, that no dependence can be placed on such requisitions. What method, then, can be devised to compel the delinquent states to pay their quotas? Sir, I know of none. Laws to be effective, therefore, must not be laid on states, but upon individuals. Sir, it has been objected to the proposed Constitution that the power is too great, and by this Constitution is to be sacred. But if the want of power is the defect in the old Confederation, there is a fitness and propriety in adopting what is here proposed, which gives the necessary power wanted. Congress now have power to call for what monies and in what proportion they please, but they have no authority to compel a compliance therewith. It is an objection in some gentlemen's minds that Congress should possess the power of the purse and the sword. But, sir, I would ask whether any government can exist or give security to the people which is not possessed of this power. The first revenue will be raised from the impost, to which there is no objection, the next from the excise, and if these are not sufficient, direct taxes must be laid. To conclude, sir, if we mean to support an efficient federal government, which under the old Confederation can never be the case, the proposed Constitution is, in my opinion, the only one that can be substituted.
Yes, so when we look at this, they talk about this direct tax. Well, the direct tax was the last resort because the impost was to be the primary. And as a matter of fact, there were points in time where the federal government didn't have to tax the states at all. They
yes.
didn't have to because they were making enough money on the imposts and the excises.
So here's a question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
And here's something, again, that I think would benefit the audience is to understand what's the difference between what is an excise, what's a duty, and what is an impost. Because most of the people in the last three generations or four haven't understood what you just described and see taxes as, I hear people constantly saying taxation is theft. And to have a government, you need to have some form of taxation. Probably not what we're doing right now.
Okay,
but
so
excises, imposts, and duties. This was something like you said. Sometimes you don't even have a direct tax.
Yeah. So to be clear, most people do not understand that the federal government's limitations of taxations were clearly placed into these three forms. The impost is a tax that the federal government places upon all objects, all things that are being imported into America. In other words, that's how they made their money, from the salt, from the fish, from raw materials, from fine goods, what have you. There was a levied tax upon all of these things, and that's how it made its money. And because when you look at how many, you know, there's trillions of dollars of goods that are imported into the United States every year. And we're talking about, what is the GDP of the United States? I think the GDP is somewhere around $20 trillion. Is that not right?
I don't know.
If you look it up, the GDP has probably gone down.
$23 trillion.
Right. So the GDP, that means that's how much we have produced. Now, when we look at what we have, what we bring in, most people hear and they understand that we have a trade deficit. In other words, we're bringing in more than what we're producing, which means that we're bringing in more than $23 trillion of goods on a yearly basis. That's more than sufficient if taxed properly on imposts. If we look at, you know, how things are. But the problem is not taxation. The problem is spending. The federal government does not have the authority to spend money on anything. They can only spend money on what they have the authority to spend it on. In other words, as they spend money on social engineering, from education, labor, all of these different things that they're manipulating us with and regulating us with, that they have no authority to do, it's all fraud. And the money that they spend and the debt that they take to do this, the Build Back Better, these vaccinations for the world, the trillions of dollars that they're writing these checks for are all fraudulent money. So they have the legitimate way of making money in imposts, which are the taxes on importation of goods. The next is excise. An excise tax is a consumption tax placed on specific goods that we consume. There's an excise tax on tires. There's an excise tax on tobacco, excise tax on, you know, alcohol. There's these excise taxes that the federal government makes a little amount of money off of your consumption of these goods. Now, in the framers' day, there was the Stamp Act, which basically put an excise tax on everything. And so, and it was like a tenth of a percent that they taxed everything. And, you know, to the people back in those days, a tenth of a percent, we're not talking about a penny to the dollar. We're talking about a tenth of a penny to the dollar. And that broke the back of our framers. They said, that is just terrible. And look, we're paying 20 some percent. On income tax, not, that's just their income tax. Let's add up the excise taxes you're paying. Let's add up, you know, the importation taxes that are added to everything you buy that's foreign. We're paying extra. That's where the taxes are coming from. So anyway, when we look at these three, the duty tax is the last and final tax. The duty tax is the direct tax. It is a tax when the federal government looks at its budget and says, okay, we've brought in this much money from imposts. And the whole point is to try to balance these things out so they don't have to play the fluctuation game. where, you know, they have to hitch up with a big duty tax because things didn't work out the way they planned on imports and or imposts and excise. So when they actually are functioning really well, the duty tax goes away because what they want to do is they want to fund themselves on this little bit of consumption and all this importation. Now, as we look at the duty is a direct tax. Technically, income tax is a duty tax. It is a direct tax that the federal government says we need this much money. And now that they've injected the 16th Amendment to directly tax income, then they now have, as a part of their duty tax, the ability to directly tax not just the state, but income, personal income, a person's income. There's nowhere in there where they have the ability to tax corporations. The only way they got corporations into this picture is by court rulings, where a court ruled that corporations become individuals and given mm-hmm. them individual status and started granting them and basically elevating corporations in our society that they had no constitutional authority to do. So the direct tax on income is still constrained based on Article 1, Section 8, that all taxes, duties, and imposts. I mean, let me go to the Constitution because the uniformity clause is very, very clear. And so, again, this is Article 1, Section 8, and this is the preamble. The Congress shall have, this is the preamble. Again, they're laying out this, why they're granting themselves these general powers that they list after the preamble. That the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, all direct taxes, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So to have a progressive tax towards a person's income to punish them because they're making more money is unconstitutional.
So even with the 16th Amendment doesn't address...
It did not modify and nullify the uniformity clause. Correct. In an amendment, it has to touch every part of those things. If there's a constraint on the taxation, such as uniformity, that tax must be uniform. All the direct taxes must be uniform. Well, the direct tax of income, there's no statement in the 16th Amendment saying that they don't have to be uniform, that they can allow them to be progressive.
Hmm. So I was looking up a couple things just out of interest. Okay.
Uh-huh.
We had our GDP is $23 trillion. We collected in 2019 $2.5 trillion for taxes for imports, and for taxes for 2021, for example. Our U.S. Well, this is U.S. tax receipts. I was looking for income tax receipts, and I didn't get that right.
Right.
U.S. So I'll income tax receipts. I'm just curious to know what is for us.
Yeah. What you have to do is you have to look. So in the spending, it's outlays, right? And so when you look at the income, you have to look at revenue streams because there are three different revenue streams. There's a direct, impost, and excise. And so you can actually kind of look, and they actually can give you the statistics of how much money they make off of alcohol sales, how much money they make off of, I don't think the federal government is getting an excise on marijuana, but I think they really want to, because it's all about, the more money they make. And folks, it's not about making money. Government is not there to make money. They're there to function, and the taxation should be based on what the functions that we've required them to do. Not to say, if we can make more money, we can do more. No, the Constitution does not allow that. It only allows them to do those very specific things. So a dutiful government actually maintains its taxation based on the powers delegated and what it has to do. But this concept of taxation is theft is an anarchical concept, because it basically, it says that, in other words, government is theft, because, you know, governments are actually instituted by men. So the fact that we're instituting government, we're stealing from ourselves. That's anarchical. Yes. Okay. So anyway, hopefully that kind of help everything kind of regarding this. Okay.
Right. I wanted to do that again for the benefit of the audience, because, you know, to understand what an excise, a duty, and an impost is, I thought would be important.
Okay. All right. So now we've kind of, we're back to where we left off, you know, as far as time-wise. We're now January 22nd, and now we're moving down to the guns section, and this is on page 53.
Okay.
And I think this is important. This is why it's highlighted.
All right. Let me catch up with you.
Okay. So this is Mr. Sims. It's on page 53 at the very bottom. And let me see. Actually, Mr. Sims.
I got it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, this is in blue, by the way, folks.
Right. Okay. I'm ready when you are.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned according to its numbers, and a power was given to Congress to collect the same in case of default in the state, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress, is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors, harpies, perhaps, from another state, but who, however, were never known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. In an age or two, this will be the case, and when the Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, their servants, will be the tyrants of the village, by whose presence all freedom of speech and action will be taken away. Wow, that sounds prophetic.
Well, actually, because this is an anti-federalist comment, and he's actually making an absurd assertion. And so this is really, this isn't about guns as much as it is about a standing army. And this is really about the execution of the laws for tax collection, because they become the collectors. But actually, who becomes the collectors? Because you have to read further down in these powers to understand who the collectors are. So the question goes to this. When it came to the excise tax of whiskey, and the whiskey tax was being applied, and there were, you know, there was a rebellion against the collection of whiskey tax. So who had to execute that law? Who became the collectors of the law?
If I remember correctly, the militia was called.
Yes.
But it was the militia of another state.
Of other states as well. Well, Pennsylvania was there too. So they had the Pennsylvania militia. They had the Virginia militia. Maryland and New Jersey were called as well. So they had four states that they basically called to suppress the insurrections that was rising, the treasonous behavior. See, the people of Pennsylvania may not have liked the law, and they could have complained with First Amendment petitions to actually go in, and that's what they were supposed to do. They didn't do what they were, because by this point in time, the Bill of Rights had already passed. And so they now had the right of petition to basically say, you have no right to do this. Instead of protesting, their responsibility was to take civil discourse to the government and say, you can't do this. The problem is that they could. In other words, had these people done the due diligence and tried to argue that this was unconstitutional, it was unfair, you can't do it, it would have been exposed in that process of civility that absolutely they can, because the Constitution has empowered them to be able to actually create excise taxes, and that this is a uniform tax throughout the Union.
Okay.
Whether you like it or not, that's how it has to be. And so that would have actually, you know, And that's what should have happened. But because these men, and again, the Bill of Rights was already created because these men chose to rise up and protest, what was the result of their court trial?
They were convicted of treason.
Two men were convicted of treason. In other words, these were the key conspirators of the resistance and the protest. Correct. Two men were convicted of treason, which the penalty thereof was hanging. They were to be hanged. Now, Washington commuted their sentence. He pardoned them because he thought it was an important learning point so that everybody understood. But I truly believe the way this is being taught, because I deal with conservatives. And when I say a conservative, I talk about, you know, maybe a right-wing Christian person that doesn't understand the Constitution. But there's way too many conservatives out there that don't understand the Constitution and do not understand that the right to protest is not a constitutional right. Mm-hmm. That civility is ingrained in this system, that we have a system and it works if you use it.
I surprise people. I surprise audiences when I ask them to help me find the right to protest in the Constitution. And then I introduce them to First Amendment petitions, civil discourse with consequences. Right to protest isn't there. And in fact, I show them that protests can become uncivil. And we've got that. We've got myriad examples of that over the last 3 years. They can get out of control.
Right. You have a right to peaceable assembly.
Right.
But correct. The problem is, and this is why, you know, when you really look at it, when we peaceably assemble, where can you peaceably assemble? Can you peaceably assemble in the road? No, because that there's laws. Every state, every city, every county has a law that you cannot be standing in a road. That's an avenue of commerce, and you have no right to block the flow of commerce.
Correct. So when you're to peaceably assemble means that you might stand somewhere, but you can't step on the rights of someone else.
Correct. So, in other words, you have a right to peaceably assemble as long as you're abiding by the laws. So you can peaceably assemble in a park. Now, many cities have created, you know, these safety, you know, measures that you can only have so many people in the park and they won't allow you to have, you know, your group show up there because they're afraid that you're going to exceed the safety number. Now, I believe that a lot of that's arbitrary. In other words, they're creating a safety number by a certain condition, but and usually this is a place where they don't use the parks for concerts and those types of revenues, because usually when they do that, then they, you know, this the number for safety goes up a lot because it's about money now. But right. But more importantly, it is property that is for public use. Mm-hmm. So if it is a private home that is strictly a private home and nothing else, then you don't have a right to peaceably assemble on somebody's property.
Right.
But you do have a right to peaceably assemble on public property or private property for public use. What's private property for public use? Well, believe it or not, a church. A church is a private property that is open to the public. And you can actually peaceably assemble at any church, any school, you know, any institution out there like Walmart, as long as you are, you know, abiding by the laws and allowing access. So the problem is if you go and on a Sunday and you protest or you assemble, peaceably assemble in a church parking lot, but you take away the ability for people to bring their cars in and park to attend church, then you're actually violating their right to access and for worshiping and so forth. So you're denying them of their civil right. Now, so Paul, we're going into a break. So hold me to this because we want to close this out as far as so people understand public use property and how to peaceably assemble, because understanding this is how we become very powerful when we exercise our rights of peaceably assemble and petitioning. So folks, we'll be right back after this promo. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. All right. Well, folks, we've got Paul back with us. And so what I'd like to do, Paul, is kind of cover where we left off.
Okay.
And so we were talking about protesting. Because we've gone down a rat hole, folks, and this is going to take a little while to kind of peel all of these things back. But as I was saying, we have a right to peaceably assemble, but we do not have a right to peaceably assemble in a hostile manner by denying, you know, some public land, the use of public land to be perverted from, you know, Walmart being able to do business to where we lock them out. We don't have that right to do that, but we do have a right to actually use that because it's land for public use. We can peaceably assemble there. And as long as we're, you know, respecting their rights of commerce, we can actually do this. Now, I know when you've done this, you know, actually you've done it out in the parking lot, right?
So what I've done is I go to the far end of the parking lot and I've got signs that I put on my truck so people know what I'm doing and they stop. And so what happens is I don't want to infringe on their business at all. But when I'm in a prominent space on the other side of the lot and I've got a big sign, I've had people stop, you know, especially with my petition number one, you know, remove Biden, ask me how. I've had people stop and say, have you got something to sign? They don't even look at the
So there you go. See, folks. And I can't emphasize this enough. I tell people, you know, if you put the little marketing out, people will come over because there are so many people in America that want to see Biden go. And we have the opportunity of doing it. Congress could do it today. But they're not because they're choosing to play political theatrics. And, oh, well, we're going to do this. And you know, it's like, who has the leverage? You know, we have to stop. We have to stop them from being able to play political leverage, political theatrics, and we have to stop them and get them to actually start doing what the Constitution dictates. But so it right. goes down to this concept of how the courts, how our laws, and how our government has basically created a set of rules that becomes a double standard. They'll allow, you know, the intrusion or the blocking of city roads and city sidewalks and the blocking of commerce, you know, throughout an area of town, as well as they will allow the pillaging and the vandalism and the damaging and the scourge to be created in the city. But boy, if you're a conservative and you actually are trying to, you know, have people sign First Amendment petition, because this happened in Michigan, or I think it was either Michigan or Minnesota, and I reported it last summer, where a lawyer was out trying to get people to sign First Amendment petitions, and she was arrested. And so they've actually kind of created these laws. So this goes all the way back around to, you know, this whole webbing of this government that is actually fighting anything that's constitutional. It's become hostile towards this. And this is why definitizing the Constitution, this brings me back to how important this act is, that you can actually definitize the Constitution starting at the county by using a common law grand jury. because a common law grand jury can go through and start definitizing principles within the Constitution, as well as making a declaration that the only Constitution that they recognize in this county is the organic or the original Constitution ratified by the 13 colonies and not the annotated Constitution, that they will not, you know, bow to a perverted interpretation of the Constitution, that the only interpretation of the Constitution that is legal is the ratification debates of the federal Constitution, as well as every amendment, the congressional debates of what these amendments mean, as well as the states as they've defined them, if they actually debated and defined them. Because the states, you know, when it came down to the 16th, 17th Amendment, they may have discussed them. They may have actually said things. They may have actually, but whether those things are tied directly to what Congress said or if they were outliers, because a lot of things that they may have said at the state level won't even hold water, because when it came to the 14th Amendment, there was some real clarity during the congressional debates. These things have been interpreted or misinterpreted at the state level, at the court level, and at all different government levels, to where they have used these things in advantages for themselves by perverting them. Just like the concept of protesting is a perversion to our right of petition. And the right of petition is a very specific act where you hold government and your public servants accountable. A protest is basically a tantrum that a citizen has out in public to say, I don't like this. But it has no weight, and it is not holding government accountable. So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, what I've learned about First Amendment petitions from experience is, and you've said this before, it's documented. I had the term documented civil discourse with consequences. I protested before or, you know, rallied without infringing on anyone's rights. But when you get done with a protest, well, what happens? Well, you go home, you have to shower because you sacrifice your time, you probably sacrifice a little money. And when you're done, what have you accomplished? Okay. When the people you protested to, when they go home, what do? You know, they probably forget the next day why you were even there. That's why you need a petition, because you put the facts in their hands and you put your instructions in their hands, because right, they're your public servants. So you instruct them that something is not going according to the Constitution or the rule of law, right, and then you expect a response from them.
Right. But so when we look at conservative protests, you know, and not to pick on, but to specifically pick on Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck went to Mississippi to a bridge, and they went out and protested, you know, because it was a site of a civil rights gone wrong protest. I forget the town in Mississippi, but nevertheless, you know, what did he accomplish? Did he actually get, you know, a petition signed to actually holding government accountable to some standards? Or no. What was accomplished was a lot of people got out, you know, because they knew Glenn Beck, or they listened to him. Actually, they just listened to him because, you know, he's not a man of the people. He's an entertainer of the people. And so he got out there, he said a few things, and what it did was it gave you an opportunity to meet people you never met before. So you got to meet people, and what else did you get? Well, if it was a nice sunny day, you may have gotten some sun exposure, some vitamin D, maybe some, you know, melatonin, you know, skin color tanning, what have you, skin burn. Or if it was rainy, you could have gotten a cold. So, you know, how weather kind of affects, you know, or gives you some things of being out there. But bottom line, you've really accomplished nothing in accordance to gaining ground regarding our government and holding it accountable, period. And government is laughing at you because, aha, look, oh boy, look at all the people that Glenn Beck got out there, and they accomplished nothing.
So here's something interesting. And I think when we look back at something Marshall did, we had this in a previous conversation, that the courts probably led us to the idea that protesting is something we should do, when that's not necessarily so.
That is correct. And the mechanism we actually have to undo all of this, and we probably need to go through this, because Republic Review is the ultimate process. But at the county level, we have common law grand juries that can make clarity. They can definitize the Constitution. They can clarify, you know, what these things mean. What is a Republican form of government? What is a First Amendment petition? And what are the expectations? So Bob Schultz has, I think, made a huge mistake by constantly fighting the court system to try to get the courts to acknowledge that we as people, when we petition government and they fail to redress our grievances, we have a right to be, you know, exonerated and out of their tax base. We no longer have to pay taxes. Had Bob Schultz gone down this path of actually going into and creating a constitutional county, because this takes a lot of work, you got a lot of focus, you know, in all of these different counties to do this. But if you get constitutional counties to form common law grand juries, then these common law grand juries can make these declarations that, yea, verily, when people protest government and government fails to redress their grievances, they are no longer accountable for paying taxes. And they can actually protect their people from having the IRS or anybody coming in to pay any taxes. If they've been protesting or they've actually petitioned both state and federal government and both have laughed at them and said, we're not going to do anything, then they are now excused from paying taxes.
Right. I think that I think you probably ought to do a show on this.
Like this?
Yeah, well, I mean, that covers the details.
Yeah, you mentioned this another day. The common law grand jury is something that we really do need to – what does it take to get there? You know, what does it take to create the constitutional county and all of that? But I'm telling you, there are states in the union right now. I think in Missouri, you've got some counties that are, you know, fit to be tied. And I think the county commissioners and everybody else, their heads are spinning. They don't know what the heck is happening, and they care. They want to see a constitutional solution, and they just don't understand it. And so, you know, it's just a matter of getting the counties throughout the union in Wyoming, South Dakota, Missouri, Montana, because I was talking to Mr. Scadam of Montana earlier this week, and we were literally talking about, you know, he says, well, how many counties do you think in Montana are ready to go? And I said, you know, they have about 50. So I said, it would probably be reasonable to say 5 to 10%. So that would be 3 to maybe 6, something like that, that you have counties, because there is a likelihood that you would have at least a couple of dark red counties where all the people there are really good people. They just don't know what to do.
Right.
And that's, you know, so this is where I, you know, we keep going back to these old adages, knowledge is power, but it's only power when acted upon. So when we teach these people, do they have the fortitude to actually take the action? If they don't, folks, you got to vote them out.
Right.
We need people that are actually going to take the knowledge and exert it as power and, in, you know, create these common law grand juries and start actually becoming, you know, this spectacle that will be suppressed in the news media. Mm-hmm. They will do everything they can to keep people from knowing what's going on in that county.
Right. Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, they will try to spin it. You know, the next thing you know, they're covering this huge, you know, incursion that the federal government has surrounded this county, and they're going house to house because there's been this huge treasonous movement, you know, against the federal government.
Yeah.
When actually it's this huge patriotic movement that is demanding compliance of the Constitution.
That's what it is. So
right.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, now that we've kind of and this is the danger of repeating and talking stuff, because sometimes we cover things in private conversations that we don't necessarily cover, you know, through the volition, because we think we've said those things. But moving on, so the next one that we're on, I believe, is the corporations by Mr. Jones. We just kind of covered the guns. And so
let me get back there.
Okay.
there was a subject that I wanted to bring up. Oh, I thought we were going to do. Oh, did we miss corporations? I thought we were going to do guns. So we need to go back up to corporations by Mr. Jones.
No. Yeah. So Mr. Jones of Boston. We just did the guns in blue. So the corporations right. is next. So this is.
Oh, I see. Yeah, there it is.
Right okay. There. So this is page 54.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. Enlarged on the various checks which the Constitution provides and which, he said, formed a security for liberty and prevention against power being abused, the frequency of elections of the democratic branch, representation apportioned to numbers, the publication of the journals of Congress, etc. Gentlemen, he said, had compared the people of this country to those of Rome. But, he observed, the comparison was very erroneous. The Romans were divided into two classes, the nobility and the plebeians. The nobility kept all kinds of knowledge to their own class, and the plebeians were in general very ignorant, and when unemployed in time of peace, were never ready to revolt. Excuse me, were ever ready to revolt and to follow the dictates of any designing patrician. But, continued the worthy gentleman, the people of the United States are an enlightened, well-informed people and are therefore not easily imposed on by designing men. Our right of representation, concluded Mr. J., is much more just and equitable than the boasted one of Great Britain, whose representatives are chosen by corporations or boroughs, and those boroughs in general are the property or at the disposal of the nobility and rich gentry of the kingdom.
There you go.
So here they, right. So here they are referring to corporations again in Great Britain.
Yes, they are. But there's actually quite a bit that he covers in this. This is very meaty because he also talks about Rome and how Rome had two different, you know, forms of people: the common man who were ignorant. And the noblemen or the noble class, and they had all the power and they kept all the power. And it's the same thing that was occurring in England, that they were creating these corporations to ensure that the nobility class in England was maintaining the power. And so they were creating a system that actually didn't allow, you know, either side to obtain an advantage of power. Based mm-hmm. on how the Constitution and its design, it actually allowed people to, you know, have this, what it's a symbiotic relationship. Again, I go back to the people must hold government accountable. We have the power. It's empowered in the First Amendment. It is our tool, and we have to be very educated on this. And what they talk about here, because they talk about, you know, the ignorance of people and how, you know, basically, you know, the best way, because right here, but continued the worthy gentleman, the people of the United States are an enlightened and well-informed people and are therefore mm-hmm. not easily imposed upon by designing men. Now, at that point in time, education was self-done. In other words, mm-hmm. the churches provided teachers and tutors and so forth, but it was homeschooling, and the parents were directly involved in the curriculum. Sure. In other words, the education system, the reason why America was enlightened is because we had the best education system in the world. So when you're the enemy and you want to take down, you know, America, when you're the enemy of America, you look at what its strengths are and you have to take its strengths away from it. So mm-hmm. this enlightenment had to change. We actually had to move away from enlightenment. And when did that happen? It happened with Horace Mann when he actually created an indoctrination education system sure. by bringing the Russian-style military education academies into our school system in the 1850s. And
right. so Horace Mann and I think John Dewey were
Well, Dewey was in the 1930s, absolutely. Okay. But Horace Mann was in the 1850s when he traveled around the world, and he basically suggested that we model a single system. Well, see what happens when you model a centrally controlled system. In other words, you implement a system that's the same. Then you tie itself to its relevance, and next thing you know, it becomes a self-licking ice cream cone, which is very destructive. If you don't have standards, and if you allow, you know, this constant competition in education, then you're going to find the reason. So I like pointing this out, that in the times of the ratification of the Constitution, Massachusetts was the most advanced state in the Union. The life expectancy of an adult in Massachusetts in 1790 was 70 years old. That's a high life expectancy, especially for the time, because everywhere else it was 10, if not much more, lower than that, 60 to right. down into the 40s. And so, well, why was that? It was because they were the most educated. They were the most enlightened people. So enlightenment has everything to do with what's best for society and best for everyone. And by they were a very disciplined society because they governed themselves with, you know, moral laws that they realized, you know, that by embracing the laws of nature, nature's God, they created laws that did not allow prostitution, did not allow these types of things. But it was not hardcore criminal laws. It was spiritual laws. In other words, the way they enforced this morality wasn't by the law necessarily in the books of government, but by the community that, you know, if you were a person that was doing that, then, you know, they were shamed. I mean, you brought shame upon your name and your family. And
there was honor meant something.
Right. Yes. And a scarlet letter, you know, of how, you know, you had to bear your shame or what have you in the community were different ways of doing that. Well, that made people feel bad. And, you know, as everybody has gone to feel bad, they go, you know what, I don't want to feel bad again. So I'm going to support this idea of, you know, implementing systems that don't have us feel bad. Eventually, we debase ourselves because what society ends up doing is society tries to remove the consequences of sin and bad behavior. Instead of being enlightened and disciplining ourselves and working to actually be more productive and, you know, not focused on the addictions and the feel-good things in life, but to be as productive as possible and to be, you know, as advancing in all these different ways, we debase ourselves.
Yeah. I heard something. I think I'm not sure it's correct. It's when you mentioned Horace Mann. I think it was the Prussian system, is not the Russian system. Prussia was was kind of a German state, and that's what he brought the regimentation.
Yes.
And the standards that came with a Prussian.
Yeah, it was a military style, system. And you're probably right. Yeah, it probably in my mind I just confused because little things like that always throw me off.
I'm bad with names. And the other thing about it was regimented, and so you have students sitting in a classroom in rank and file. Okay, that's a regimented system.
Okay,
right. So anyway, I don't want to belabor that.
Yeah, let's get this next one in because this is a good one. I want to end the week off with. It's about jurisdiction. Okay. This is by Mr. Pierce, and it's on page 56. And he says, "Okay, read away."
While I'm up, Mr. President, I would make some observations on what has been passed over, as I think it is within the orders of the House. The Honorable Mr. Sedgwick said, if I understand him right, that if he thought that this Constitution consolidated the Union of the States, he should be the last man that should vote for it. But I take this his meaning to be this, according to the reasoning of Mr. Ames, that it is not a consolidation of the Union because there are three branches in the Union, and therefore it is not a consolidation of the Union. But, sir, I think I cannot conceive of a sovereignty of power existing within a sovereign power. Nor do I wish anything in this Constitution to prevent Congress
being sovereign in matters belonging to their jurisdiction. For I have seen the necessity of their powers in almost all the instances that have been mentioned in this convention. And also last winter in the rebellion, I thought it would be better for Congress to have stilled the people rather than the people from amongst themselves, who are more apt to be governed by temper than others. As it appeared to me, we were in the disqualifying act, as in my opinion, we then did not keep strictly to our own Constitution, and I believe such a superior power ought to be in Congress. But I would have it distinctly bounded that everyone may know the utmost limits of it, and I have some doubts in my mind as to those limits, which I wish to have solved. I have also an objection as to the term for which the Senate are to be in office, for as the democratical branch of the federal legislature is to continue in office 2 years, and they are the only check on the federal, and they, the Senate, to continue in office 6 years, they will have an undue influence on the democratic branch. And I think they ought not to continue in office for a longer time than the other. And also that if they conduct ill, we may have a constitutional revolution in as short a period as 2 years, if needed. The Honorable Mr. King said some days past that the Senate going out by classes, if rightly considered, were not for but 4 years, because one third was never more than six, another four, and a third two. Therefore, the medium was four. But I think that way of arguing would argue that if they were all to go out at the end of 6 years, that they were but 3 years in office, because half their time they were under the age of 3 years, and the other half over the age of 3 years in office. Therefore, his arguing to me in that respect was not well founded.
And so, obviously, this is an anti-federalist, but the point is that he's arguing against this concept of the Senate, but he's discounting the roles and responsibilities of the Senate versus the House. In other words, I don't think that Mr. Pierce really had a good grasp on the Senate's responsibilities were far different than the House of Representatives. And the reason why it needed this continuity is because treaties took time. You know, these engagements that they had to deal with took time, and they couldn't just be flushing the Senate and senators every 2 years like they could, because it doesn't matter. When you look at the House of Representatives getting rid of somebody today, the only reason, you know, people actually look, oh, we can't get rid of this person because they've got such seniority. You know, they're in charge of these committees. Well, let's look at these committees. Most all of the committees that they have created in the House of Representatives and in Congress are all over unconstitutional powers. I mean, they wouldn't have hardly any committees, you know, if they were kept within the framework. And the fact that they have this tenure is absolutely repugnant to a concept of a representative government, because tenure should not be the issue. It should never be the issue of, oh, well, this person, we have this credibility or what have you. I apologize, Paul. At least we got this through. And so on Tuesday, maybe next week, we can sum this back up, or we can bring this back up on Wednesday whenever we have you back. Thank you for coming. I just didn't even realize that we just completely ran out of time. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.